sure if this is here better or down there was better. Can everyone see this? Yeah? Okay. I'll make myself a bit comfortable here for a second. What you didn't know, that this thing comes off. And great, and this is my personal assistant, Danielle from South Africa. Please, everybody give her a hand. She's here for the first time. Thank you so much. Okay. Good morning, Boker Tov. Guten Morgen. Could we have the first slide just in the background? That'd be great, Evan. Thank you. I'm really excited to be here. This is like my home, my oldest home. Hey, Homer. How you doing? Good to see you here. This morning, I'm going to speak to you about yet another part of my journey with the Lord. Bringing me back to the land, having thought I've left for good. And that is Kite Pride, Second Winds for Kites and People. So you can see I brought some props. I'm a teacher, so you'll hopefully bear with me because it's going to be a bit of an interactive kind of morning. Yeah, so we have a kite here. I also have a jar for oil, and I've got bags. So we'll figure out through the sermon, if it's going to be one, I think so, how these things all work together. So I'm going to introduce myself to you quickly. Who am I? Okay. I don't know if y'all can see, but here is a little house and a tree. I'm from Germany. I love my bite. BB stands for bite in Berlin. So I come from a very big family. It's been growing. I've got 5 siblings. My parents are involved in a family ministry in Germany, something like Focus on the Family in the States. And my siblings are married, most of them, and have kids. So I'm an aunt, which I love being. I've come to Israel the first time in 1994 with King's Kids through YWAM. As I never wanted to come to Israel. I had no connection to Israel at all. So this is the first one thing that I didn't want to do ever. But I found myself getting a rejection to a King's Kids outreach trip to Africa, knowing that that was the right thing because I knew I had to come with a group of people from Switzerland, which is another important country again in my life, to Israel on this trip, this reconciliation trip. It was Palestinian, Israeli, Arabs, Christian. Their identity is white. They will have to choose and pick and tell you how they would want to present themselves to you. I won't step into that place. And Israeli Messianic believers and internationals. And when the Lord calls you, it hits you sometimes like a bomb. And the Lord really spoke to me on this trip and called me and said, and here I have a lot of work for you to work with young people. And it was like a visual, like a audio voice when we were walking back to the airport that summer. And I was like, what? What was this? I came back after I finished high school the next year to be a nanny in Jerusalem in Baca. I lived just down the street from the Kopp family and went to Ulpan, where I met Gary Alley, who was sitting in class with me. And this is how our friendship began. And he, I think you brought me to the Baptist house back then. You were a journeyman. Homer was working in the bookshop up there, looking out the window sometimes, waving down. So this is my first connection to the place here, and finding myself most of the time in the kitchen of the Kopp family, where Sharon was making some Ethiopian food, or you don't know. And the journey just, it doesn't go down, Danny. We had a discussion earlier if it's going down to 2018, but it's basically maybe going around and up again. So I was here for that year helping with the King's Kids to get started and learning about Jewish life, family life in Israel, took care of four little kids. I'm still friends with the family today. Shabbat dinner with them last night. And it was, yeah, everybody here in this congregation then, they love to study, and they were academics. So I'm sitting with Dr. Randall Booth and having Parashat Shavuah discussions on a Friday Shabbat dinner while we were sipping a little whiskey, and, you know, and I'm thinking like, wow, this is really interesting. I need to study. So I love studying. And after I came back with my first degree in education, I also signed up for Hebrew U to do my master's in religious studies in the Second Temple period, because this is what you do after you've been in this congregation. I found out maybe this is more a hobby for me, and you don't really make a lot of money in this field. So, but I really liked being in Israel, and I knew the Lord had called me, so I was wondering, like, so, you know, I'm here now, God. You let me know when you want to do something, because in the meantime, I was having a ball. It was in 2001 I came back, right in the middle of the Intifada. Brian Kwasnicka back then picked me up with my mountain bike coming from the plane, dropped me off at the Booth's house so I can cut salads for the wedding that was about to happen. So this is how I came back. And yeah, a year and a half. It took God a year and a half to show up back then, and to be like, okay, let's start this. I was on fire for the Lord, and he brought me to start working with young people here in the Messianic body. And that led working to in the Jam, being a youth pastor there, and then starting an organization called Yad Beyad, which something also I never wanted to do. This was another calling of taking German and Israeli youth together through Auschwitz. And I did this for 8 years. I spent most of my summers in Auschwitz, my birthdays too. I have just a real heart, and this has been a journey of my life, of reconciliation, topics like forgiveness. I've been to so many camps here with Palestinian Christians and the Messianic youth going through Wadi Rum and places, and just feel that this is so much the heart of God to repair the broken. And to experience standing in Auschwitz, knowing that God's grace is bigger than this place. If not the cross and if not Jesus, then what? And to stand in the place of the greatest sin, grace is even greater. And that for me as a German, with my Jewish family that he put me in. So this is a bit of my heart and background. So I went back to Hebrew U to study conflict research, do another master's, this time in Hebrew. And then when I finished, I was like, now what? I'm not a citizen. I've been here 14 years. Can't make Aliyah. This country doesn't like Christians very much. They like their money and come to travel. So I was going a bit of a crisis, and I felt I need to leave and maybe start roots in Germany and Berlin. I'm talking way too long already. And so I moved to Berlin. It was a bit of a crisis, finding myself. I've become Israeli by then, and wondering what God has for me there. So I thought, you know, PhD in reconciliation in the midst of conflict. And there was a good program with Professor Mohammed Dajani, who took Palestinians to Auschwitz and stuff. But the whole thing fell through. And the next thing is I find myself running a refugee camp with 1,000 refugees in the middle of the crisis in Berlin. Knowing this is where I need to be. It was some stories I can tell you. You can ask me later. So I worked with refugees for 2 years, and with the Jewish community in Berlin who would come into the camp doing mitzvah days, reaching out, Holocaust survivors sitting with people from Iran and Afghanistan, helping them to learn German. And somehow, this wasn't it. So last year, around this time, I had a dream. Three friends of mine came to me in a dream who live the Pex family, Racheli and Moria and Judy Pex. They came to me and basically called me and said, you know, I don't know, you have to come. I woke up crying like crazy, called them. I said, I don't know what happened. I'm between jobs. I don't know what to do. What should I do? Racheli was like, come to for Pesach to Eilat. So I come. I'm in between jobs. And the whole time in Pesach, I don't know what I'm there. I'm not going to come back to Israel. Come on. I've just left. I've sold everything. I've sold all my house. I'm in Berlin now. And the week is over, and I'm sitting with Stephanie, a Swiss girl, who's married to Jonathan, in the car on the way back, and it was this amazing rains, and there was rivers in the desert flowing, and we got out to swim in them. It was amazing, something I've ever dreamed of. And we started talking, and on the way up, because finally there's less people around, because there's always 1,000 people around, they were like, hey, you have an interesting story. Why don't you come and work for us? We need someone like you. And I was like, oh, no. No, no, no. That's always been one thing I really didn't want to work with because it's too hard for me. Working with people who've come out of human trafficking and the sex industry, these people are, that's really hardcore. I don't know if I can deal with that. Wow. I don't know if that would be for me. So there was a process that started where God has started working on my heart. And I'm standing here today. You see me, right? So, yeah. What happened? I sold all my stuff in Berlin. My brothers were celebrating, yet Karen lives again. Her stuff is in half of a garage at the parents. Found out in January mice were living in my clothes. So I'm here, and I've been since October working with this amazing organization that's transforming the face of Tel Aviv and the and lives of people. We are a social startup business, and that's going to lead me to introducing you to a bit more what we do and how I feel like I'm going to church every day, and I have a privilege of so impacting people's lives that I've never thought was possible, and I had it in me because it's really the grace of God. Kite Pride. So, why is this important, or what do we do here? I'm going to quickly tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to give you a bit of a background about the what's, okay? Human trafficking, what it is, global facts, Israeli facts, what could be solutions for this. And then move over to why we do what we do, or what could be, what is needed in this field of work. How do we do it? What are there our steps that we do and how we work? And would we, if we could dream, where would we go? What would be the vision after this? So, you ready? Okay, great. Now I need my notes. And these things over there. PA? No. Okay. So pretty much, what is human trafficking? I'm going to read you a bit of a definition quickly. What that has been the general accepted definition of this. Human trafficking is the illegal trade of human beings. It is the recruitment, control, and use of people for their bodies and for their labor. Through force, fraud, intimidation, people everywhere are being bought and sold against their will right now in the 21st century. There are more slaves in the world today than ever before. What kind of types of trafficking do we have? There are many forms of trafficking, including forced prostitution, forced labor, involuntary domestic servitude, child soldiers, and organ trafficking. So, how many people do you think become victims of human trafficking per year globally? What do you think? Thousands, if not millions? What else? Any, this corner here? 10 million. What do you say? 50 million. Okay. That one. So, worldwide, there's 2.5 million people become victims to human trafficking per year. How much does the industry make per year? What do you think? How many dollars does industry make per year? Same number at Three Knolls. This woman, she's cracking it. You guys better. What do you think? 100 million, Gary. Good. Need to talk. 4 million. Okay. Yeah. All right. So it's 150 billion US dollars that is made in the human trafficking industry in the world today. How many victims are rescued? Give me a percentage. 1? Were you peeking my notes? Yeah. So due to limited enforcement of the law, very few children, women and men who are trapped in slavery are ever rescued. 1%. Okay, that's huge. Now, Israel. How is this possible? In Israel, the Holy Land? Yes, it's happening in our backyard, my friends. I work with these people every day. How much does the Israeli sex industry make per year? What do you guys think? Dollars? Dollars, okay, here. Okay. In Israel, the sex industry brings 120 billion shekel per year. How many brothels are visited per month? There are brothels. There are 1 million visits per month to brothel. Yes, 1 million men or go and to buy sex service. And how many women, men, and children do you think are currently sex workers in Israel? 10 million, 5 million? You're really in the millions. Anything here? Maybe an idea? Pretty close. So we have 12,000 women, men, and children who are currently in the sex industry, enslaved. And what's the average age of entry? When does a person start being or maybe working in the sex industry? 15. That's very good. That's very close. It's between the age of 13 to 14. That's the age when the average age of getting into this. I can tell you stories, which I'm actually going to do in a second. Now, how is this? What's the problem here? And now I need, yes, this one. How is this? What's behind all this? What's the problem? It's like prostitution is not only a global problem, it's a problem here in Israel. And the problem is that it's not illegal. So crime under Israeli law is not allowed to advertise sex or lead a person to prostitution, purchase sexual services from a minor, or maintain a location for the purpose of engaging in prostitution, such as a brothel. Nonetheless, prostitution is still a vast phenomenon within the minimal enforcement in place to help victims and reduce violence against women. Now, underlying of this problem is that we have there's a demand for it. If there wouldn't be a demand, we wouldn't have to supply. So this is like the root of the problem, that men think women can be bought, sex can be bought, or even we have transgenders or transvestites who work on the streets, so that sex can be bought. And there's a demand for this in this country, and that's basically fueling this whole business. So there will be a supply. One thing would be, do you have the law? And that would be very important, and this is actually what the Jerusalem Institute of Justice is working on right now. There's a Nordic model that's working in Sweden, where the demand basically is made illegal and criminal by the law. So they're trying at the moment in the Knesset here to get this through, that those people who purchase services of sex, that they will be, that death will be criminalized, and not the women per se. In Germany in 2002, the law, prostitution was legalized, and we can see here that that didn't work because prostitution went up 30% and 3,500 new brothels were opened just in Germany, and it didn't bring any, you know, gender equality, empowerment of women. I don't think any woman is voluntarily working in this industry by herself. So we really don't want to follow in the footsteps with German law enforcement, but more the Nordic Swedish model that illegalizes the purchasing of sex services. So we have this saying in our work, real men don't buy sex services or women. You know, people close deals in big companies in Asia and they take them as a gift, as a thank you to a brothel. So this is like happening, and it's like a thinking that's there and that needs to change, and we need to educate on this. And it's the education where we'll start changing our thinking and how we see people, that this can only change, including with the law. So I'm going to tell you a story before we move to the next. Let's call her Nadia. Nadia was a girl from Moldova. Moldova is the poorest country in Europe. A person in Moldova makes less than $5 per day. 55% live under the poverty line. In 2014, there was an economic crisis because of an Israeli oligarch. You say that right, like this? Ilan Shor robbed the banks of $1 billion and basically caused the country to fall in more debt. The money just disappeared from the banks. He was a Moldovan Israeli Jewish guy. Moldova is also second in the human trafficking of the countries in the world, been rated second highest. So Nadia here, she is, grows up, was born in Moldova, and into a poor family. They don't have any money. And she has a dream. She wants to sew. She wants to make things. But school is expensive. You need to pay for the school, and it's really difficult. And when she was 20, she met a young guy who was really nice, And she thought, okay, at least get out of the home. The home is a mess. Dad is a drunk. Father, mother is not really there. It's not really working. So I'm going to get out of here and marry, and this guy will treat me better. They have a kid, but the guy isn't really what he thought what was supposed to be and turn out to be, and was beating her and was drinking. He wasn't getting jobs, and she wanted to go to the school though, and had to pay for the schooling, and it was just difficult with the kid, and it didn't work out. So she left the guy, and while she was trying to see how she's going to survive, she meets another man. Wow, this guy, he's got money. He's nice. Takes her out for dinner, buys her things, gets her clothes, tells her, promises her the world, we're going to run away from here to Europe and going to make a living in Germany, because there they pay you really well and you could work with your hands and be great. And then I'm doing all this business and I'm so important, and she just feels so special. So finally someone who sees me, who understands what I want. This is great. I love him, the love of my life. He's coming to take me away from this misery. And suddenly there, he has a bit of a problem with his business, and he tells her, look, I need your help with something. It would involve kind of like having sex with someone, and we would, you know, but then I would get some money back for something that I've done, and you would really help me out. And of course, she loves him. She will do everything for him. So that happens, she does it, and all of a sudden, this relationship changes, and he calls her a whore. How have you done this? And he's like, well, now we have to go. We have to go to Germany, and anyway, there we will have a different life. So he takes her along, takes her papers away, brings her to Germany. They're out of Moldova, and there he suddenly has urgent business, and gives her into the hands of another guy. This is my friend here, meet so-and-so. Maybe he's in Berlin or down south in Munich, I don't know. And in the right moment, she always gets her papers back. So she's kind of come voluntarily. She doesn't feel she's being forced to come. And it's always this relationship. She doesn't get it. Sometimes he's so nice, and then other times he just beats me. And other times he just, like, makes me do things that I don't want to do, but I love him, so I want to go with him, and he's promised me the world. So she's just in this whole dilemma of an abusive, codependent relationship already. And the guy then drops her off with his friend, says, I have business to do, leaves, and never comes back. And that's where the story starts. This is where probably she's been brought to a brothel the first time. This probably didn't want to do the work. So they rape you continuously till you're broken, till you comply to it. And then the journey goes from there. Maybe you work for an escort. You're brought to... She's in Switzerland. She's in Luxembourg. She's all over the place. And one of her journeys, she comes to Tel Aviv on a tourist visa. That's how they come in here. They work in homes and private apartments. She doesn't have her papers. She's stuck. She's broken. Her identity's gone. All her dreams she ever had, this guy promised, are crushed to the ground. Where can you go from here? So there's... This is probably sort of a true story of one of the girls who just hired last week. They're stuck in this, and maybe people think maybe you want to stay in that, maybe you like these jobs, or people who have gone on the streets with the age of 15 to make money because they don't have any way to live and to play for their lives. Also, people we've hired, that's their story. No economic, no finances. But it's 75% of women have stated, and 50% of men shared that they would like to leave this industry. They don't want to be in it. But what's keeping them? So there is a financial debt. They're up to here. can't pay them to a bank, the bank would immediately come and take the money. So we pay with special checks to some of them until we've helped them cover up their debts. And they don't have skills. Maybe they think, I don't have anything. I don't have anything to give. I don't speak the language. I'm stuck here. They speak Russian. I speak with one girl. She's deaf. She was human trafficked here from the Ukraine. So I'm learning sign language in Russian, speaking Switzerland, America, Israel. Thank you. Wonderful, wonderful women, people. And it's just such a big mountain. How, if you're ever out of this, how to start a life when this is all I know, this is what I've been trained to know. You're stuck in this, in your mindset. And of course, one of the human trafficking has one of the highest rates in PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and causes depression because you've been broken and broken and broken over and over and over again. Evelyn Chumbo, she's an anti-trafficking survivor herself and an activist. She was interviewed by CNN and she said, it is not unusual for a survivor to fall back into trafficking situations because they lack resources, language skills, education, and it is a struggle for many survivors to build a successful career. And as a member of the U.S. Advisory Council Against Human Trafficking, she says, there are times when I feel like screaming on behalf of all human trafficked survivors because what do they need? They need jobs and not pity. And most of all, they need love. Love and healing. And this is exactly what we offer at Kite Pride. This is where we come in. People get saved. People get, there's organizations in Tel Aviv who do amazing work getting them out of these places, who have them living in hostels or in shelters where they need to be protected from the mafia guys who've brought them here. Some of my girls are constantly being caught to the police to kind of identify people and things that's going on. And they are get saved and they go through rehabilitation. There's Magan, there's Salit, there's Atlas, even human trafficked men, a lot of the men. And then they've been through rehab and they're getting better, but then what? There's still an economical problem. There's still a problem of, like, what can I do? I've never worked a normal job in my entire life. I don't know. I've worked at night. What is a 9-to-5 job? And what would be a safe employment where I can feel and don't have to be afraid that someone's going to hit me the next moment, was my time saying. Okay, good. So, and again, I'm going to tell you a story of where we find a solution to this in the Bible. And I'm going to take you to 2 Kings 4 to our prophet Elijah. Elisha, not Elijah. He's a cool man. I like him. Elisha and the widow's oil. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord. Yeah? But the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be slaves. So Elisha said to her, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in your house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in your house but a jar of oil. Then he said, go, borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons. Then pour into all the vessels and set aside the full ones. So she went with him and shut the door behind her and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Now it came to pass, when the vessels were full, that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said to her, there is no other vessel. She poured all from the one jar of oil. She had poured all of them full. Then she came and told the man of God. And he said, now go, sell the oil, pay your debt, and you and your sons will live on the rest that you make. Great story, huh? We have an economic problem. A man of God, this woman, her husband has died, and she's left with a debt. Her heart is broken. She's alone. What's she going to do? They're going to come and take her sons to be slaves to pay off the debt. Now, what can we learn, or what have we learned from this story as we work at Kiteprite? What can we learn from this story? First of all, there was a simple question that Elisha asked her. I love this. What do you have? What do you have? What do the women, the men have that come to me? They probably think they have nothing. I have nothing. I have just debt. Look at me. She had a jar of oil back at home, which was, that's one pricey thing. That's probably the only value she had. But they have hands. They have a great mind. They have a body. They have a good heart. That's what they have and what they can bring. And we can train that and teach them. So this is what we do. We ask people, what do you have? Come as you are, and we will hire you, and we will give you a job. And you can probably think, like, the thoughts that are going on in this mind of this woman when she's like, what is he doing? He's sending me home to collect jars? Like, what is this? What? Like, so I haven't introduced to you, actually. This would be the second slide now. The people behind all of this. This is Tabea and Matti Opliger. These are the founders of Kiteprite. And she's found in a global act in Switzerland fighting human trafficking in 2011. And in 2014, they felt called to come to Israel to start up a business that would help human traffic victims. They just walked into the Misrad HaPnim, and we're talking with the women from the Misrad HaRevacha. Hey, we want to come and volunteer in the country, but we don't have anyone inviting us. Who do we need to talk to? So the head of the Misrad HaRevacha, who does manages volunteers, she said, I do. And let me invite you to come so you can work here. So this is how they came. Got the visa from the top manager in the Misrad HaRevacha, who works with volunteers in the country, and got the invitation to come here because they said, hey, we want to work with human trafficked people here. Great, we need, it's exactly what we need. Come, please. They've just gotten their work visa after 3.5 years this week, which is amazing. Yeah. And what did we start doing? I'm going to cut the story a bit short because I'm looking time. But, so this is going to become the fun part. Do you want to help me? I'm going to pass this over your guys' heads. Is this cool? We started collecting kites. How crazy. They're both kite surfers. And, hang on. So one thing, and you can talk to Jackie out there, who's helping us with selling stuff later. We collect kites from kite surfers all over the country. And there, I could have the picture, actually. Wait, hang on, sorry. So maybe the next slide. So, catch 27. Amazing. We thought we were crazy. We went and going around. This might have been... yeah, so we collect kites. We've been on the Kinneret from Eilat to Akko, all the way up north, and we upcycle them. Not recycle. Recycle is something else, but we take amazing material. This is like the best material you can... You felt it just now. Yeah? There's like 150K running into this, people flying on the beaches and holding them up. So there's this like amazing material. And we were donated by a Swiss kite surfer a way to produce bags that we could easily teach the trade to women who've come to our shop, to work in our workshop. So this is one thing we do. We teach environmentally to live ethically with the environment, where landfilling in Israel is still a habit, and it's like, for me as a German, it's like a no-go. Unbelievable. That stuff that should go in is going in the trash, we can make something amazing and beautiful out of it. So we've been designing, and this is what I'm going to pass around now too. This is what comes out in the end. We will pass them, you can feel them too. This is a backpack, then we have a classic bag, it's going to have a zipper now, we're always developing things. I sew, but I'm not a seamstress, guys. It's just like... Danielle, you want to pass these from here? And the other one? So just feel how that is in your hands. Is a little... Those little bags, we don't even have them online yet because they're being sold so fast at the moment. So our oil, we collect the kites, and the bags have become our oil. We make these products, and did I have something more there? Ah, good. Yes, coming to the end. and sometimes you're in this and you're thinking, oh my gosh, are there ever going to be enough kites? Who's going to buy our stuff? Our stuff is not cheap. It's designed. So we're into the fashion world. In upcycled fashion and designer world, we have one shop in Yafo that's selling our things. We're sending into the whole world by now, little by little, and trying to break way. And as Jackie out there, she's our sales and marketing, she's breaking the head. We're trying to get to the places where a bag is not sold for $50 or a 20, let's say, but to the shops that have the fashion and the cool things and the best things, because we want excellent with these women and we want to pay them a good salary. So from the 10 women that have been with us, and men who have been with us, two have actually already now moved on to normal jobs, which is great, just in the last 2 years that we've been working. And so we have unique design with an amazing quality of the bag, super light material. You can put your kid in there. My friends moved their whole house from Eilat to Germany just now in our bags. And I was like, where are the pictures? Oh, we forgot to take them. I was like, dude. And then, so we have creativity. We have people who come in to volunteer with us from all around the world who are into graphic design, into, you know, creative arts, like Danielle. You came. You can talk to her. Why did she come? She's one of those stories who's come and is giving 5 months of her life on her own pay to be with us. And all the while, this is my daily bread, where I am suddenly a social production manager, and I work with these girls day in, day out, 8 hours a day, to restore lives and to give them back value and share with them, you are precious, you have something to give. We teach them our family values that Tabea and Mati have in their home, which is called Rega, which means Rega comes for respect, excellence, generosity, and attitude. And we go over these things with them because they've been on the streets and they've been surviving. And we just love them and love them and love them and love them more. And they're pouring their hands has become oil in our vessels. And the kites have become oil. that we are now trying to connect, to find people who want to help us get this on the way so we can pay jobs and invest in lives, help them pay their debt, and give them assistance and care. If we could dream, and how can you be a part of it? So this is, you can become an Upwind partner, this is what we call you guys. People who share what we do, people who buy our products. You're partnering with us, that's amazing. We need prayer, I need lots of prayer. I sometimes don't know what to do when there's a crisis, when there's an explosion. This last month was so hard. But God always gives me grace, gives me the solutions. If I had enough sleep, it's amazing. Gary, don't laugh. He knows me too well. But we are looking for professionals also who can start taking this over so we can move on and build more Kite Pride workshops all over the world. Because there's places in Holland, in Germany, India, Bangladesh, or even go to Romania and Moldova and create jobs for people. And the second is to help stop the law, to make it criminal, to purchase sex in the sex industry. And that this will come through in Israel. Pray for this, that this will become a criminal act. And this is what I can only invite you guys to. Yeah, pray for us if you know professional social workers or someone who's an entrepreneur in business, who would like looking for a job as a believer. We're looking. And may you all fill your jars and share what you have. Because you're all blessed and you're beautiful and you're perfect how you are. And you've got something to give. Thank you for listening. Amen.